Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. In October, we reported that Chesapeake Energy had drilled a series of oil wells near Douglas, very close to people's homes. Chesapeake says the area will likely continue to be a core drilling region, and that has some area residents uneasy. Willow Belden reports.
Chesapeake has 55 wells running in Converse County and plans to keep drilling for at least the next few years. And they're not the only company. The Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission permits 250 to 300 new wells in the state each month, and many of those are in Converse County. County Commissioner Mike Colling says the oil boom is boosting the area's economy.
Our motels, hotels, gas stations, and so forth should be doing a great business. That's good for the businessman.
But some people are worried. Janice Switzer lives a few miles outside of Douglas, and her subdivision is surrounded by a ring of new oil wells. This summer, Chesapeake started flaring the wells, which is when they burn off the gas that comes up as a byproduct with the oil. When the flaring started, Switzer's garden died, and she began having headaches. At a public meeting that Chesapeake hosted this week, she expressed frustration.
I'm still having headaches up there. When I wake up every day, my house is shaking because the flares are so big. I still haven't been even contacted by anybody to say, at least, we're sorry, what can we do?
Todd Parfit with the Department of Environmental Quality defended flaring.
The flaring itself is a control device, and the purpose is to remove those hazardous air pollutants or volatile organic compounds to destroy those.
In other words, you pollute less when you burn gas rather than just venting it into the atmosphere. But Jill Morrison with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says flaring can still cause problems.
It's destroying some of the pollutants, but it's still, when that flare is going off, you're still emitting pollution. Initially, when these flares go off, they are burning a lot of the contaminants that I think come from the fracking, and those are going to affect people who are also nearby who are breathing that air.
It's hard to quantify the risks because DEQ does not have an air quality monitor in Converse County. The agency is planning to bring in a monitoring device next year, but some residents say that's too late. They also feel regulators aren't adequately patrolling the well pads. This summer, several flares let off black smoke for days on end, which meant they weren't burning cleanly. But nobody fixed the problem until residents complained. Todd Parfit with DEQ says the agency doesn't have the manpower to keep an eye on every well.
We do rely a lot on residents and the public to notify us if they see something out in the field that's of concern. The reality is that we can't be everywhere all the time with our staff.
The Oil and Gas Commission imposes a 15-day flaring limit on companies, but since Chesapeake doesn't have a pipeline to transport the gas to market, they applied for and received an extension, which allows them to flare several wells for up to 6 months. Jill Morrison with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says that's way too long. She'd like Wyoming to adopt tougher rules.
If you cannot put that resource in a pipeline to be used to produce energy, then you can't drill the well, or you can't produce that well until you can get that resource in a pipeline.
Some community members also have concerns about potential health risks associated with hydraulic fracturing. And there are social concerns related to the oil boom. Parents worry that an influx of rig workers could lead to higher rates of alcoholism and crime in the community. And they're annoyed by the increasing truck traffic. One rural road that used to see 8 vehicles per day now sees 800. And then there are concerns about another blowout. This spring, one of Chesapeake's wells blew out, spewing gas into the air. Now, wells are being drilled much closer to the road, and that's led to concerns that if there were another blowout, emergency vehicles wouldn't be able to get through. Chesapeake's Sandy Andrew responded that another blowout probably won't happen.
That is a very, very unusual event in our business. We're taking great strides to ensure that that does not happen again, and that if an incident like that were to occur, we deal with it quickly and appropriately.
Since this is the first time this type of wells have been so close to residential areas in Wyoming, some want the state to adopt new rules. For instance, groups like the Powder River Basin Resource Council want Wyoming to put a halt to drilling within a several-mile radius of homes. Currently, wells can be as close as 350 feet to a house. Even Bob King with the Oil and Gas Commission says it's worth considering that type of change. But in the meantime, more wells continue to spring up throughout the area. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden. In the last several years, states have received fewer federal dollars for highways. During the energy boom, the Wyoming legislature made up for the shortfall by providing periodic funding for construction and maintenance. But the Wyoming Department of Transportation wants long-term and stable funding. After spending the summer looking at the issue, a legislative committee could only agree on one substantial plan, a 10-cent increase in the state gas tax. Bob Beck has more.
State Senator John Hines of Gillette is chairman of the Senate Revenue Committee, and in fact, he's been a Revenue Committee chairman for much of his legislative career. Hines is not one to support many tax hikes, but with WyDOT facing a shortfall, he's prepared to support increasing gas taxes from 14 cents a gallon up to 24 cents.
Some people think they can be more efficient and cut down, but I think they can to a certain extent, but not for $67 million and maintain what we expect them to do.
At a recent public meeting, representatives from major organizations in the state showed up and expressed their support for the tax hike. Some of these are groups who are usually a bit timid when it comes to tax increases. This includes the Wyoming Mining Association and the Wyoming Taxpayers Association. WTA Director Aaron Taylor says they support the tax hike because they believe that a stable source of funding is needed.
We march it against our cornerstones of taxation. Is there a justified need? Is it transparent? Is it stable? Is it equitable? Does it meet these principles? And if it meets the majority of the principles, we can support something like that.
But not everyone is so thrilled. During the public hearing, Cheyenne resident Victor Ciccone complained that a 10-cent hike is too high for those on fixed incomes, and he criticized the legislature for what he sees as a tax-and-spend approach. Ciccone also noted that the legislature has been putting a lot of money into savings in recent years. He suggested spending some of that money instead.
If the state can rat hole money every year or every 2 years, why not take a percentage of that money and apply it towards WyDOT funding?
The governor said last week that the gas tax hike is expected to cost a family of four $114 a year. And he added,
if you raise the 10 cents tax, that you wouldn't necessarily see a 10 cents increase at the pump.
Mead says that increase will likely be spread across other items that a gas station sells. However, the Wyoming Liberty Group's Maureen Bader says there is no proof that the gas tax will even be used for highways. She notes that highway revenue is currently spent on a number of things.
Already some goes to recreational trails, university technology transfer program, ethanol tax credits, leaky underground fuel tax. So the increase in tax doesn't mean an increase in spending on roads.
State Senator Cale Case is calling for further study of the Wyoming Department of Transportation's budget to try and get a better understanding of how they use money. Case says some decision-making by WyDOT may have led to more spending recently. The department has spent a lot of money in recent years building passing lanes and two-lane highways and improving how roads are built.
We're wider, flatter. Well, we have a lot more higher standards. And that's a good thing, too, but that's part of our cost.
But the senator's biggest concern is that the gas tax will not raise enough money to address the shortfall. He says the state should be pushing hard for a toll road along Interstate 80. But support for that idea has been lacking. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll talk with Governor Matt Mead about his budget proposal, and Matt Laszlo explains why Wyoming members of Congress oppose extending the wind production tax credit. This is Open Spaces.
Thanks for listening to member-supported Wyoming Public Radio. Today, we're asking you to help support great programs like Open Spaces during our year-end membership drive. If you're already a member, we thank you and ask that you consider an additional year-end gift in any amount. Pledge online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Your contribution helps pay for the cost of NPR and BBC News shows. It also supports this program, Open Spaces. This is a unique Wyoming news program devoted to issues facing our state and the West. We designed this program to give you a comprehensive news program specifically about Wyoming. It is possible only because of your continued support. Help support in-depth news coverage of Wyoming and the West with a pledge now online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last week, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead released his proposed budget, and he will present that budget to the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee on Monday. The budget features some cuts and a couple of policy decisions. The governor joins me now. One of the things that you were challenged with a little bit was dealing with the revenues that you had available to you as you crafted the budget. I'm curious, as you look ahead towards the legislative session, if, for instance, the 6% cuts that some of the agencies might face, if you might assume that some of those reductions might be reduced a little bit, just knowing that the legislature has a little bit more money to play with than you did.
Well, that part of that whole issue of the legislature has more money to play with than I did is part of the reason why I proposed the fiscal policy changes that I've had. But in direct response to your question, I suspect there will be some movement because the legislature asked for 4% cuts, and I asked the agencies to prepare 8%, and we ended at about 6.5%. And I know anytime you make cuts, that is going to be controversial with some folks, and there's going to be pressure applied in terms of whether those cuts are too much or too little. So, yes, in answer to your question, I wouldn't be surprised if some of those cuts they think are maybe too deep. And maybe, on the other hand, they'll think some are not deep enough. But I would probably predict that they would go the other way. They would lessen those cuts.
Will you make the case to try and keep those at 6%?
I think we've got a good case to keep them at 6%. And it's not because it's easy. It's because for the message that I provided in my budget is that, we're facing some uncertain times here. We have to be fiscally conservative. We worked very hard with the agencies over the last 9-10 months to prepare this. And again, not without controversy and consternation, but I think this is a sustainable budget, and we have to recognize we're starting from a framework where the budget more than doubled over the last decade.
Visiting with Governor Matt Mead, we're talking about his budget. He'll go before the Appropriations Committee with that budget proposal on Monday. I want to ask you about the Wyoming Department of Transportation. This week, we saw the legislative committee go ahead and give an endorsement for the gas tax that you'd called for last week, which would raise it 10 cents. One of the things legislators at that meeting, though, when we had a chance to talk with them after it, continue to bring up is they're unsure of what the Department of Transportation budget looks like. And we almost compare it to the Department of Health, where there's a lot of federal money coming in there. There's some other sources. And while they were in favor of increasing the gas tax for now, there was a little concern that maybe they don't know what's in that budget, and it needs to be possibly looked at like the Department of Health is. I'm curious how much of conversation you've had with legislators about that and if you agree with that.
Well, actually, I think it is appropriate to make sure we have a good handle on what their budget is, because they have the commission side, the federal money, and then they have the state general fund. And, it wasn't always the case where they got a lot of general fund dollars and other dollars from the state. The commission side was the big dollar amount. And that is why partly, people wanted me to sign on the fuel tax immediately. And I said, I think we have some more work to do with the Department of Transportation to make sure we are using every penny wisely and we know where those pennies are going. And I have pressed the Department of Transportation on that, and they've responded well. And this month we're going to get some additional information on them, from everything from value engineering to how we are doing our projects. Are we doing them in a cutting-edge fashion to try to eke out every penny we can? So I think that's a legitimate concern. But on the other hand, I don't think you can just say, hey, we don't know what the budget is. I mean, the Department of Transportation, if you want to go over there and go through their budget, they presented this summer a very, very detailed budget, both on the state side and the federal side. Now, it's not easy to go through, but the information is there, and we've been going through that with them. But the fact is, with regard to fuel tax, we need a predictable funding stream. In my first session, I asked for a portion of severance tax to fill that need, and the legislature has declined that. And so if you're not going to provide a portion of severance tax, I think we have to be looking at that fuel tax.
Well, when you had your press conference last week. You asked us all to have an open mind on Medicaid. You weren't ready to endorse the expansion. Are you feeling, though, like you're leaning that way?
No, I would truly say that as I sit here today, I'm probably leaning the other way. But, you know, and I understand that can be a frustration to some people, but last count I heard roughly two-thirds of the state haven't made a decision on that. And as you look around the country, both Republican and Democrat governors, one thing we do have in common is we're asking for additional information from HHS. It is a big decision, and it's a tough decision, even if you had all the information. But when you don't have the information, it makes it all the more difficult, because I'm the one that has to answer and say, this is what we're going to do, and here's how it's going to impact you, from everything from your health care to how it's going to affect providers to what it's going to cost you. And we just don't have that information yet. So as I lean here, I would say that I'm, you know, where I am in my budget now is to not do expansion if and until we find out additional information. But I deliberately asked the Department of Health to provide a budget request asking for expansion, because I think it's going to enlighten the discussion and enlighten the debate. We need to be looking at all those numbers. And so Director Forslund put prepared a budget asking for full expansion at my request. And I've denied that, but I'm trying to couch it so that we have to have the debate. And when I'm talking about an open mind, we should have an open mind. I mean, it shouldn't be just a partisan issue, Republican, Democrat. It should be an issue, what is best for the health care patients in Wyoming and the providers, what is best for the taxpayers, how is it going to affect the bottom line of Wyoming, and also what is it going to do to the federal budget.
One of the things that has been troubling to people is what it does mean long term. I mean, Director Forslund, in my conversation with him, sounds like they're actually – he believes there might be a long-term savings.
That is one of the other things I asked him to do is, you know, what is it going to cost us? And he thinks with offsets that it could be tens of millions of dollars of savings in the next 5 or 6 years. Kaiser Foundation just recently published a report that says in the next 5 years it's going to cost us $90 million. And I think his savings are – he's predicting in 5 years it will save us, you know, about $50 million. So there's a huge discrepancy. One says it's going to cost us 90. One says it's going to save us 50. And I think part of that discrepancy is that we don't have answers to the questions we've asked in letters. And so many of the rules and regulations have not been promulgated, let alone being finalized yet. And I think until we get some of those rules and regulations finalized, it's going to be difficult for the to predict exactly what the cost and or savings will be. Director Forslund does believe there's a savings. The Kaiser Foundation says it's going to be an incredible expense.
We'll talk with you later, Governor. Thank you for making time for us, and thank you for joining us in Open Spaces.
Thanks a lot, Bob, for having me on.
Wyoming Republicans in Washington are advocating for phasing out the wind production tax credit, which has helped give the state a robust energy portfolio. Matt Laszlo reports on the future of the tax credit in the near and long term.
It's no secret Wyoming's three lawmakers have had their careers propped up by the oil and gas industry. It's either been their top donor, as is the case with Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis, or their second biggest donor, as is the case with the state's two senators. But that doesn't mean the delegation isn't proud of the state's renewable forms of energy. Senator John Barrasso says he's glad the state is expanding its portfolio.
We have all the renewables, so, and we have world-class wind, so there have been a lot of efforts on wind energy.
Even though they say they support the state's wind industry, Wyoming lawmakers are calling for the end of a tax credit that incentivizes the production of energy from wind. Barrasso says that tax credit is masking the real cost of wind energy. He says it's time to take off the mask.
So, you know, when the president talks about wanting to make renewable energy the cheapest form of energy, he's not doing it by actually lowering the cost of renewable energy. He's doing it by raising the cost through the EPA and other regulations on some of the more affordable forms of energy.
To be clear, the delegation has been supportive of oil and gas subsidies. But Congresswoman Lummis says there's no comparison.
They're mixing apples and oranges.
Lummis says it's unique that wind producers receive a credit of 2.2 cents per every kilowatt hour they send to the power grid.
If you can show me an oil and gas credit that oil and gas gets that is the equivalent of the wind energy credit, I would agree with them, but I can't find a credit.
Lamas says oil and gas producers are merely working on a level playing field with other industries.
Deductions that are available to oil and gas businesses and candy manufacturers and tinker toy makers, that's comparing apples to apples. So I'm all about treating people the same under the tax code. But I don't see oil and gas getting a production credit. You know, if I'm wrong, I'm willing to stand corrected.
Environmental groups see things quite differently, though. Courtney Abrams is a clean energy advocate for Environment America.
The oil and gas industry has received subsidies from the government for decades, and the treatment has been quite different between oil and gas subsidies and the renewable energy industries, in that the oil and gas get permanent subsidies, whereas the renewables have to fight every year and do this boom and bust cycle to get tax credits renewed.
Abrams argues the wind industry in Wyoming and elsewhere would take a massive hit if lawmakers can't work out a way to renew the wind tax credit, called the PTC, by January.
In past years, when Congress has allowed the PTC to expire, wind installations annually have dropped between 73% and 93%. So we could see wind projects that are planned to be built not being built at all without the certainty from Congress.
That would ripple through the industry, potentially costing thousands of people their jobs across the U.S. Some in the wind industry support phasing out the tax credit over a long period of time, possibly in 5 years or so. Ed Burnett, a union president for a Pennsylvania chapter of the United Steelworkers, warns against moving too fast. He says even just extending the tax credit temporarily would have a negative impact on the industry.
I would say that it would be pretty devastating to the wind industry with only a one-year extension.
Burnett says his plant is looking to upgrade its facility so they can manufacture a larger windmill blade. It could take a year just to overhaul the plant.
A one-year extension really is pretty much like someone telling you, I'm going to count to three, and you tell them to go ahead and count, and the first thing that they say is three. Well, you're done before you started.
Wyoming Republicans aren't moved by those arguments. Lummis says she supports a rapid phase-out of the credit that has transformed the U.S. wind industry.
It's time for it to go away. It's time for wind energy to stand on its own two feet.
Some Republicans want the tax credit ended as a part of negotiations to cut the federal debt. Currently, the debate is focusing on personal income tax rates. Once the two sides answer that question, they'll be looking for savings in other parts of the budget, which is why wind producers are so worried. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we'll hear how archaeology work done in Mongolia is shedding light on the prehistoric people of the Rocky Mountains. This is Open Spaces.
This is our year-end membership drive. Today, we're asking you to consider sending an additional gift to Wyoming Public Radio. Or you can become a new member by pledging online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Your contribution will help Wyoming Public Radio finish out the year in good fiscal shape. It also allows us to continue producing Open Spaces. Since its debut on Wyoming Public Radio, Open Spaces has examined many significant issues facing Wyoming. Your contributions have also made it possible to podcast Open Spaces and to offer related web material on our website. Please support fact-based journalism and in-depth coverage of Wyoming with a pledge in any amount online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We're joined now by Matt Kaufman with the Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. He and his colleagues are getting started on a new study about sage-grouse core areas. So Matt, tell us what you're trying to find out with this study.
What we're interested in is essentially whether or not the sage-grouse core area policy, which is an executive order that was put in place to conserve sage-grouse, has additional benefits for other species that use sagebrush, and in particular mule deer, and in particular the migrations of mule deer.
And of course, that's something that we hear a lot, that, okay, protecting sage-grouse habitat will protect other animals. Why do we have reason to question that that might not be the case?
Right. Well, I mean, so this is part of what ecologists call kind of the umbrella species concept, that, you know, by protecting one species, we might be able to protect other species that use similar habitats. And in this case, I mean, on the face of it, we know that that will be true to some extent because sage-grouse habitats and mule deer habitats overlap. But where they overlap is on the winter range of mule deer. And so most of the mule deer populations in Wyoming are migratory. That means that they overlap with sage-grouse habitat on their winter ranges, but then the mule deer migrate up to higher elevations, up to the forest and to high elevation habitats for summer. So that's a portion of the year in which they don't overlap with sage-grouse.
So in other words, it'll help other animals for part of the year if we protect sage-grouse territory, but it might not help them for the whole year.
Well, that's right. So that's what we're trying to find out. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of focus on sage-grouse right now, and there are other species that use sagebrush habitat and that are also influenced by energy development. And the one in Wyoming that is the most important is mule deer, and in particular migratory mule deer. And so what we're trying to understand is how much of so mule deer have migration sort of route networks, and a network as they get off their winter range and they go up to their high elevation summer range. And we know that some of that is going to be protected by the sage-grouse core areas, but we know other parts of it are not. And what this study is trying to do is quantify which parts of the route network are protected by the sage-grouse core area and which part are not.
So how do you do that? How do you go about figuring this out?
So it's basically a big GIS exercise. So it's an overlay. So you overlay all the mule deer migration route networks, and then you overlay the sage-grouse core areas and evaluate which parts of the migration routes are protected and which parts are not.
And why is this so important to know?
Well, right now there's a lot of interest in conserving mule deer migration routes in the state, and there's a lot of effort being done. For example, you know, you can point to the recent work up in Pinedale with the underpasses and overpasses that YDOT has just completed, and that mule deer and pronghorn are using.
And these are overpasses and underpasses to allow the wildlife to get across the highways without getting hit.
That's right. And then there's other you know, land trusts that are focusing on identifying and creating conservation easements in areas that are important mule deer migration routes. And so there's a lot of interest in conserving migration routes in the state. And then at the same time, there's this you know, there's this core area policy, which was going to provide some protection to some portion of the routes. And so our hope is that by identifying what parts of the route are protected by the core area policy, that might shine light on other portions of the route that aren't protected, and therefore allow conservation groups and managers to target their conservation efforts to the areas that aren't protected.
All right. Matt Kaufman heads up the Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit at UW. Matt, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
A Wyoming archaeologist working in Mongolia is shedding new light on the prehistoric people of the Rocky Mountains. Wyoming Public Radio's Sarah Hosseini has that story.
University of Wyoming archaeologist Todd Serville spends a lot of time thinking about how humans organize the space around us, in particular, our junk.
I don't think archaeologists commonly portray themselves as studiers of trash, but that's what we do. 99% of what we find in the archaeological record is refuse.
That's important because early hominids left a rather homogeneous scattering of bones, ash, and tools, while the deliberate use of space, where you sleep, where you toss your leftover bones, is an example of modern human behavior most scientists believe came about at least 50,000 years ago. In other words, how we choose where we do things is a big part of what makes us human. Serville studies nomads who lived here. The problem for Serville is that most nomads, then and now, leave very little on the ground. When you do find a prehistoric hunter-gatherer campground, the likes of which are sprinkled across Wyoming and Colorado, you are often left with more questions than answers. Serville was working on one such dig, the 12,500-year-old Folsom site in Colorado, when he found himself mulling simple things. Why are there more artifacts clustered on one side of the teepees than the other? Did people live here in the winter?
Amazingly, something as simple as that has never been studied by anthropologists in any meaningful way.
And then it occurred to him, what if there were modern people living similar lifestyles who could offer some clues?
After looking at endless spatial patterns that we discovered in the site, I felt like we really didn't have very good means for understanding them, So I wanted to view this in the real world, in a nomadic setting, where you still had nomadic peoples today.
Turns out there aren't too many places in the world left to choose from, especially those boasting temperate climates like the Rocky Mountains. Eventually, Surville settled on the Doha, nomadic reindeer herders who live in teepees along the mountain-ringed steppes of northern Mongolia, which are reminiscent of his study area back home. Surville had come up with an innovative idea. He wanted to see if he could shift the focus from mapping material remains to mapping actual people by taking pictures of a campsite from a variety of angles every 2 minutes for a month.
What I was trying to do first was to develop a completely new method for doing spatial ethnoarchaeology, which is one, mapping people, and two, using time-lapse photography to do it. So my primary goal this trip was to establish, is that possible?
This summer, Surville and a partner left to find out. After 10 bags, 3 airports, a 9-hour drive, and 20-mile horseback into the mountains, he says the Doha people welcomed them with a question.
You know, they look at you and they say, what do you need all that stuff for?
Soon, Surville was asking each teepee's inhabitants permission to hoist a camera on a 30-foot pole. He admits their reaction to the proposed neighborhood watch was focused on an issue of logistics. Where are we going to go to the bathroom now? But no one refused, and soon Surville's team was hosting nightly screenings of the day's footage for the entertainment of delighted residents, and they gave back in kind.
Surup, surup, maltop, choro, tsukur, jahin, alolabet.
Back at home in Laramie, Surville has gathered 4 research students into his office to listen to the sounds of the modern Mongolian nomads, whose images they have spent countless hours crunching into daily maps with hundreds of little red dots, which represent individual movements.
5,300 and some photos. It's a lot of photos.
That's student Kimberly Sanchez. The work is tedious, but student Travis Carlton says that studying living people is illuminating.
As archaeologists, you know, it's kind of a stones and bones deal. You don't get to see it in action.
Already, the team thinks its time-lapse footage suggests possible overlap between modern and prehistoric behavior. The Doha also prefer to hang out on one side of the teepee. It's called the woman's side, where the kitchen is located. Surville hypothesizes.
People like to hang out in the kitchen. It's true today. In my house, probably in yours as well.
But even more striking, Surville says he has discovered a perfect correlation between the temperature outside and the distance that Doha people sit from a campfire. Something he believes could revolutionize the ability of archaeologists to determine the season in which a site was used.
Now, we've excavated hundreds of hearths, maybe thousands of hearths in the archaeological record with stone tools around them. And there's the potential that that really simple and obvious finding will eventually lead to a clear way to determine what season of year that people were sitting around those fireplaces. So that's exciting to me.
Now that he's sure it's possible, Surville hopes to raise enough money to return to Mongolia during different seasons and eventually apply his research to sites in the Rocky Mountain region. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Sarah Hosseini.
Joined now by author Steve Horn. He lives between Laramie and Cheyenne, and earlier this year he published a novel called Another Man's Life. The book tells the story of a Vietnam veteran from Wyoming after he returns home from the war. So Steve, without giving too much away, tell us about the story.
Yeah, the situation is that this veteran is haunted by some experiences of wartime atrocities that occurred while he was serving in Vietnam, and that tend to now devastate the relationship that he has with the one person in his life with whom he sought atonement. And it also, he carries with him a secret from Vietnam that threatens the current presidency. So it's a taut mystery thriller.
Well, and the secret that he's holding on to, let's talk about the history here a little bit, because as you said, the protagonist here has seen things in Vietnam that the government doesn't want people to know about. Tell us a little bit about that.
The protagonist, in this case, his name is Eden Kane, and Eden was a door gunner on a UH-1H Huey helicopter in Vietnam, and he was attached to a very elite Special Forces group called SOG. Many people today have heard of SOG, but back in the 1960s, 70s, SOG did not exist. No one knew of SOG, not even Congress. And SOG tended to operate between the president, in this case it was President Nixon, and two commanding field generals in Vietnam, one controlling incursions into Cambodia, the other controlling incursions into Laos. At that time, there was a piece of legislation that was passed that prevented President Nixon from going into or bombing Cambodia or Laos. And the book follows the story of Eden's primary job was trying to extract downed pilots who had the unfortunate experience of being shot down over Cambodia or Laos, and in some cases North Vietnam. And the last thing that the president, of course, wanted was the North Vietnamese government to hold up an American pilot for the media. It was sort of the prize catch, the Cupid doll at the carnival, if you will, where they would say, look here, American people, your president is lying to you. We just captured this pilot shot down in Cambodia or Laos. So it was the job of these special forces units to go in and try to extract these pilots.
So that no one would know.
Correct.
Now, obviously, this book is fiction, but you're a veteran, and so I'm guessing some of this is from experience. How much of this story is autobiographical?
Well, you know, they say that all fiction is autobiographical, and certainly the storyline in this particular case was influenced greatly by my service in Vietnam, and I'll leave it at that.
not gonna give us any more tips there.
No, you know, I was attached to a special forces unit, SOG, and we took some rather serious oaths. And upon termination of my military career, there were lots of things that I agreed not to divulge and haven't. I think some extent in this book, I've probably divulged some things that have long met with the statute of limitations, and so it's public knowledge now. But again, I want to emphasize this. This book is a novel, and by definition, fiction.
Is there a message you're trying to get across to readers here?
There is, and I'm glad you've asked that. The message is that veterans in general tend to be haunted by their experiences in war. I don't care if you were a door gunner or an infantryman or a supply clerk. You had experiences that will stay with you for the rest of your life. At this time in American history, we have so many veterans coming back from two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, that are all trying to assimilate back into society. And my message is that these people need our patience. They need our understanding. We are welcoming them now much more than we ever did when I came back from Vietnam, where we were met by angry protests at airports where people shouted curse words at us, called us losers and baby killers, and spit at us, and where we couldn't get a job. We were actively discriminated against in many cases after Vietnam. Since then, it's been very gratifying to see the public's response. The number of organizations that have been developed to assist veterans in assimilation. And I just want people to understand that these people do have trauma associated with their experience, and that we need to support them.
Stephen Horn's new novel is called Another Man's Life. Steve, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear from a young entrepreneur in Laramie who runs a high-end rifle-making business. This is Open Spaces.
You're listening to Open Spaces on Wyoming Public Radio. Today, we're asking you to send in a year-end tax-deductible donation. Just go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on the Pledge Now link. You can also check out a number of recent feature stories from Wyoming Public Radio News. On Open Spaces, we've reported extensively on environmental concerns around Wyoming. We've looked at issues stemming from growth in our state. We travel the state to examine stories that affect us all. We sort through the legislative process to explain what our lawmakers are doing in Cheyenne. This show was designed to add comprehensive coverage of Wyoming to our lineup of NPR and BBC News. You can support this award-winning program and help us finish out the year fiscally sound with a pledge in any amount online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Hitching Post Inn, Wyoming's second capital, is the story about an iconic hotel in Cheyenne that was home to legislators, lobbyists, and others over the years. The main portion of the facility burned to the ground in 2010. Sue Castaneda is the author, and she says it was more than just a hotel.
As the title says, it's the second capital. Many of the people that I interviewed, especially legislators and lobbyists, said, you know, they might argue about politics during the day, or they might be on different sides of the aisle, but when they were at the Hitching Post that night and they were maybe padding down the hallway, passing each other, or having a drink together in the bar, or dinner in the carriage court, they would actually talk about the issues then and come to some agreement.
How did it get the stature that it eventually got? Can you kind of give us a little history on that?
Harry Smith, again, was a good businessman, and it wasn't what he started out to do. His father actually started it as the Lincoln Court, and Harry was an engineer. He got his engineering degree from here at the University of Wyoming. And I think he was just a strong, solid businessman. And he looked at every angle. How do we get people to come and stay? And so when he married Mildred, you know, she was the face. Harry was the businessman. Mildred was the face. And they did everything they could do to get people to come. They created the restaurant, even though at that time the Hitching Post Cafe was kind of out in the country. They got involved themselves in the community. I mean, they knew that by being involved, people were going to come to them. People came to the Smiths out of loyalty a lot of times, and they are also creating the newest and the best. Mildred looked at design magazines, and she knew that women would want to come there to see how to decorate their own homes. And then, of course, later, when Paul came along and he was the general manager and owner, there was, again, a different kind of loyalty. They loved Paul. And Paul threw lots of parties. And if you could ever get to go to one of Paul Smith's parties, you knew that that was the party to be at. In fact, knowing Paul, how many of us have said, gosh, what would Paul Smith do? How would he throw this party? So it's much of it was out of loyalty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, number of presidents and actually musicians, all kinds of folks. You want to tell us about some of the folks who stayed there?
You know, a lot of the people who came through Cheyenne at that time, I think, came because of Tracy McCracken. Tracy was the publisher of the newspaper. He was also big with the Democratic National Committee. He was the top, or the final vote, actually, that put Kennedy over the top to be the nominee for president. And therefore, throughout the years, a variety of politicians came, from Harry Truman to the Kennedys. Both John and Robert Kennedy came. In fact, in the book, you'll see a picture of Robert Kennedy, who came 2 weeks before he was killed. And you know, Doris Woodcock, who was the banquet waitress, head of the banquet waitresses, talked about how surreal it was and how sad she felt when he was killed. I mean, as the rest of the country did, but the fact she had just met him, she had talked to him.
You talked to a number of people who had worked there for many years, and that's one of the things I think is so interesting about this.
Del Peterson, who had been the general manager, he started when he was 15 years old. He got his degree, but he came back and worked at the Hitching Post and stayed for 22 years. And so, like me, many people who had worked there when it was burning down just stood across the street from it and cried. But when you saw it burn, you could suddenly remember everything about the place that had ever happened to you there, and certainly the employees. So Dell got together a bunch of the former banquet waitresses, and we just sat one night, and I showed them old pictures, and they just recounted their stories, and they could all remember all the things that had happened. And I remember them saying, and this is the title of their chapter about the banquet waitresses, "It's the best job I ever had or would ever want."
How do people pick this book up?
You can go to the State Museum gift shop after December 10th. It'll be at City News, as well as you can go online to hitchingpostbook.com and order it. And you can either order it and have it shipped, or you can order it and pick it up at the State Museum after the 10th of December.
Okay. Sue Castaneda, always nice chatting with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Now we'll play the first installation of a segment we're calling Upstarts. It's an occasional series where we profile Wyoming entrepreneurs and explore what makes them and their businesses tick. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with Nathan Heineke, owner of NL Heineke Incorporated, where he designs and builds upscale custom hunting rifles in Laramie. He started his business 8 years ago, and business is good, but he says it could be a while before he starts to see a profit.
The custom gun trade is actually pretty small. My clients reach me by word of mouth, and virtually all of my clients are repeat clients. The average sporting rifle that I make is a single-barreled sporting rifle, either a bolt action or single shot. And there's approximately about 200 hours of labor into each one. This is a bolt action rifle. The caliber is 350 Griffin and Howe, and this is being built for a client of mine who's going to hunt all over. They're meant to be used hard, to be repaired if necessary, to look beautiful, to handle superbly. The price for my standard sporting rifle is $15,000. It can easily go up from there. The turnaround can be anywhere from 8 or 9 months up to 2.5 years or more, depending on the complexity of the project. I am milling the trigger body to fit into the action frame, and it's a matter of doing the math to make sure it fits. Grew up in a household where we hunt every fall, fill the freezer, and then throughout the rest of the year, that's what you eat. And I've always made things my whole life. I've always worked with my hands and I've made things. I knew I couldn't just simply open up my front door and hang a shingle and call myself a gun maker. I wanted to get some experience in the trade, which fortunately led me to my first professional job working on the East Coast in New Jersey for Griffin and Howe. They are the oldest existing custom gun makers here in the States. They were founded in 1923 by Seymour Griffin and James Howe. James Howe, coincidentally, also wrote the book that started my interest in gun making. Working with the old guys in the shop, our master gun makers. What I learned from them was absolutely priceless. They could show me in a few minutes concepts and skills that you just simply cannot put into a book. And that looks like it's going to fit. Most of my clients are from out of state. The vast majority of my clients are from out of state. Wyoming, it's, I live here as much as quality of life as anything. The outdoor life, the hunting, the fishing, the shooting, low population density, clean air. The time I spend working, half of it is actually running and organizing the business, managing the business, and the other half is actually working at the bench. Building custom rifles. There are a variety of design considerations that go into each firearm. There's the functionality, aesthetics. You have ergonomics, longevity. You want something that is going to last a very long time. Not just a lifetime of use, but multiple lifetimes of use, a couple hundred years. No one design element is more or less important than the other. With a small business, the profit margin is razor thin. Prior to the recession, when work was completed, payment would be received promptly from my clients. Since the recession, there's still a fair bit of work in the shop, but I provide a luxury service. What I provide is not a necessity. And so I would be the last person on the list to get paid. And oftentimes, project would be complete, and instead of getting the final payment, it'd be a small payment here, a small payment a month later, which is very difficult to run a business on that. It allows me to do what I love to do and get paid for it. Certainly, I lead a very rich life, I can assure you that.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.